My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Annie Barrows. Annie, welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Thank you.
Let me read a little bit about you before we get started. You were born in San Diego, but you and your family moved to a little town in Northern California when you were 3 weeks old, so you don't remember much about the move.
No, thankfully. No.
Okay. You graduated from UC Berkeley, became an editor of art criticism, textbooks for high school students, fiction, a fiction and poetry magazine, short stories, and then finally books. Here's a quote from you. After I had edited a couple hundred books, I decided I could probably write one myself. So I went to writing school. That was a lot of fun. And I wrote a bunch of books for grown-ups, unquote. So we're going to hear a book for grown-ups, right? In addition to co-authoring the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society with her Aunt Mary, Aunt Mary Ann Schaefer, Annie Barrows is the author of the children's series Ivy and Bean, as well as The Magic Half. And, in fact, the title of your book is The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society, and it's published by Dial Press, and the authors are the late Mary Ann Schaefer, and Annie Barrows, B-A-R-R-O-W-S. Was that relatively complete and factual?
Yeah, that was. You got all the high points, that's for sure.
Okay, yeah, high points is what we deal with here. Let me ask you, let's start with Guernsey itself. It really is in the Isle of Guernsey, which is one of the Channel Islands between France and England, right?
That's right.
It seems to me that Guernsey, I think, is probably geographically closer to France, but belongs to England.
That's true. It's definitely a piece of Normandy that fell off. You can tell by looking at it. It's got those rolling fields that are Norman. And it came over with William the Conqueror, Duke of Normandy. That's why it ended up being part of England. When the rest of France reverted back to France during the Hundred Years' War, they sort of forgot about the Channel Islands, and that stayed with England. But it is definitely closer to France than England.
Mm-hmm. Now, in reading the book, the people in the book are English to the eyebrows, but it seems to me that it's not an English existence per se. It's almost like an entity unto itself, that Guernsey has its own zeitgeist. Can I use that word?
Yeah, it's definitely a separate culture, and they don't consider themselves to be English. I mean, they're British citizens, but they had their own language until fairly recently. I think it's sort of on its way out now, but they have their own culture, their own cuisine, their own language, their own literature.
Is it more like Breton? Is that
the... Yeah, it is. The language, yes. It is similar to Breton. And it's got that kind of Celtic thing going on. You know, then they are the source of the Guernsey cow, which is, you know, a very important dairy cow. They have their own culture. They have their own history. It's the British are the faraway rulers.
Mm-hmm. And yet, they're recognizably English as well.
Yes.
It's a large cast of characters, and I won't attempt to try to give us something about, or ask you to give us something about every character. But the ones we really need to know, we need to know about Juliet Ashton. It's a young woman who comes to Guernsey. Why does she come to Guernsey?
Well, she's been having a long and involved correspondence with various members of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. She's a writer living in London after the war, casting around for the subject of her next book when she receives a letter from a man on Guernsey who casually mentions that he belongs to a group called the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, which, of course, you know, forces her to ask the question, what's with the potato peel pie, and so forth. And little by little, she gets to know him and all of the other members, and that eventually induces her to come to Guernsey and see what it's like for herself.
You know, since we're on the potato peel pie thing, we have to talk about Will Thisbe, and because he was the developer of potato peel pie, but he's an inventor. He invented the electric clothespin.
Yes, he did, which wafts your laundry in the breeze, saving the laundress's wrists. Yes.
This is, you know, one of the things I love about the English is that not only do they tolerate eccentricity, they revere it. It's, you know, it's like their eccentrics are an exotic species that if they don't protect, they're going to disappear.
Exactly. It's sort of the way the Greeks felt about minor gods. You know, you had to be nice to everybody who walked across your threshold in case it turned out to be a god. That's how the British feel about eccentrics. You got to be really nice to them in case it turns out that they're geniuses that are going to, you know, shower you with their brilliance.
Well, in this tiny little society on Guernsey, apparently they have more than their share of eccentrics.
Yes, they seem to have more per capita, particularly in this book. Will Thisbe is a very special one, though. He is an inventor and a rag and bone man, and he also is the guy who makes up and cooks the very first potato peel pie.
And we'll get to that reason why in a little bit. This Juliet is published by a man named Sidney Stark, who is an old friend of hers. They're friends since childhood, and he became a publisher, and she became a writer. She writes a column using a variation on her name of a famous English writer, which annoys some people and other people think is very cute.
Right.
But that's what she does pretty much, is write very cute stuff.
Well, she has written a biography of Anne Bronte, she considered her more serious work and a book she's much prouder of than she is of the Izzy Bickerstaff columns. But it didn't sell. So she was sort of forced into the world of cuteness, as so many writers are, and wrote the humorous columns. But as the book begins, she's really trying to find something of more substance to write.
I'm shocked. The substantive book that didn't sell?
Yeah, I know. And it's hard.
Is that even possible?
It's hard to imagine.
when Juliet is finally lured to Guernsey, and mostly on her own volition, I think, she meets the people of the island who belong to the society. I won't go through the whole title, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. And they form this literary society not just for self-improvement, but also for companionship, I think, and self-protection. You want to tell us about that?
Well, the original formation of the society, it came about as a ruse. They were trying to avoid getting arrested by the German patrol officers, so they quickly made up a literary society.
I hate to stop you, but we really need to go back one level now.
Okay.
What happened to Guernsey during World War II?
Well, all right, we do have to go back there, because in June of 1940, the islands were invaded and occupied by the Germans, by the Nazis, and they remained occupied for the next 5 years until the liberation in May of 45. Guernsey was the only British territory to be occupied by the Nazis, and they were cut off from England and indeed from everybody for those 5 years of occupation.
Okay. So once the Germans were there, they acted more or less like Germans and made everybody miserable and hungry and worked them to death and all that other kind of stuff.
Yes.
So now, the society?
So now then we get to the society. Yeah. The Germans had set curfews. They set extremely unreasonable curfews that varied all the time. And so this group of friends was out eating a roast pig dinner that they were not supposed to be eating, and they stayed out after curfew. So as they were tiptoeing home, the Germans rose up out of the bushes and said, "What the heck are you all doing?" And they said,
words to that effect.
Yes, or words to that effect that can't say on the radio. And they said, "Why, we were just having a meeting of the Guernsey Literary Society," which they had made up on the spot. And once the Germans had accepted that notion, the friends felt that they really had to create a literary society in order to keep their ruse going. So they quickly scrambled up all the books they could find and began to read. And as this was a group of, farmers and fishermen, they hadn't really read before. But once they started reading, they discover what the world of books is. And also they discover in their fellow readers that they've found this community that will sustain them during this time.
They find depths in themselves and others that they didn't know were there. And this of course, is a writer's pipe dream. But yes, it is.
And a reader's pipe dream, too. Yeah. That you're going to find your perfect other reader out there, you know?
Yeah. I believe the woman who made up the society on the spot was Elizabeth McKenna.
That's right.
Elizabeth McKenna is not an islander per se. She came from the mainland, but has become an islander by choice and has become accepted on the island. But she really begins to shine when times are tough.
Yes, they knew her a little bit, the people on the island, but she becomes the very center, not just of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, but of a whole group of people. As they revolve around her, they come to know each other and love each other and take care of each other.
Now we can start talking about some of the people in the group. My favorite has to be Isola Pribby, for a lot of reasons. Although you got to love all of them for one reason or another. Charles Fawcett. Oh, let's talk about Charles Fawcett first, because the first poet he discovers is Catullus.
And he finds him so spiteful. He just can't believe he's saying nice things like that about nice ladies.
Yes. For those of our listeners who are not aware of Catullus, he was a Roman poet. He was a lowlife. He was kind of the Charles Bukowski of his time.
Yeah, definitely.
And he was in love with hookers. Yeah. He just loved hookers.
But he hated them too, of course.
Yeah, well,
because they didn't like him enough.
They didn't like him enough. But there was one in particular that he absolutely fell in love with. And she went off with a Roman centurion. Mm-hmm. And he used to write the most vile poems about the two of them. You read them in translation, you say, my God, I didn't know they had words like that. And Catullus actually invented vile curse words, sexual curse words for both he and her.
Yeah, well, this is when Clovis asks the bookseller for some poetry, that's who he gets, Catullus, and he's shocked. He's trying to get some love poetry so that he can beguile one of the local widows with soft words, and instead he gets Catullus, and he's horrified.
Yeah, as anybody would be. The first time I saw Catullus, I had read a poem or two before that, and I was still shocked by it. By the way, if anybody wants to read Catullus, I recommend it highly.
And Seneca. Let's not forget Seneca.
But not on an empty stomach, necessarily. Yeah. There's more about Clovis Fossey. This is, I don't know what your politics are, and it's really not necessary to say so, but he represents a point of view which I find fascinating and ennobling, I for want of a better word. He picks up a collection of poetry edited by William Butler Yeats, who probably has one of the two or three best reputations of any poet in English history. Mm-hmm. And yet he is appalled by this because Yeats says in his introduction that he is not going to include any poems about World War I, which was a formative, it's one of the most amazing things that ever happened in Europe, but it was also a formative thing for Clovis. Tell us about that.
Well, Clovis was in the First World War, and he encounters the poetry of Wilfred Owen, and that's for Clovis, this transformative moment. All of a sudden, the sky opens, and he understands what poetry means when he reads the war poems of Wilfred Owen. And to him, Owen's poems describe what he himself experienced. Only puts it you know, Owen puts it in a way that he feels he never could. And so when Yeats scorns Owen and Siegfried Sassoon's war poetry, Clovis is outraged, because to him, the function of poetry is to transform experience. And here's Yeats just sort of categorically deciding that some kinds of experience aren't worthy of being turned into poetry. Clovis is enraged. Yeah. And you know, Yeats may have one of these great poetic reputations. I personally think Yeats is a great poet, but I agree with Clovis on this one.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
me too.
And he Yeats is acting like God. He's deciding what's poetry and what isn't, which I suppose is his job as an editor, but he made a mistake.
He did. Clovis's outrage is well brought out of the book. I felt everything that he felt about that.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Siegfried Sassoon was the grandfather of Vidal Sassoon.
No, really?
Yeah, I swear that's true. piece of trivia.
That kind of thing will stick with you on your deathbed.
Try not to think of it.
Yeah.
I'd like to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Annie Barrow. She is the co-author with the late Marianne Schaefer of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society, published by Dial. This is the paperback. It did pretty well in hardcover as well.
Yeah, it sure did. It was there on that bestseller list for a while, but now I believe the paperback I've knocked myself off the hardcover list with the paperback.
This sounds like the kind of news that every writer would like to hear.
Yeah, it's not so bad.
I'm
getting over the loss of the hardcover quite nicely.
Yeah, my wife's book club, which never reads anything but that it comes out in paperback, read your book in hardcover.
Really? I'm honored.
I promise that's true. I saw the privy. Back to her. It's another one of the wonderful eccentrics. The book takes place in 1947.
Mm-mm. Yeah, 46.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to call her a hippie, but she's about as close to a hippie as you can get in 1946.
Yeah. Well, she's a natural person. The civilization means almost nothing to her. She has deep loyalties, and those are the things that form her life.
There are various things happen during the occupation that what is it? if you put people in rough situations, then they find depths of goodness and terribleness in them that they never knew they had.
Yeah.
And one of the things that happens, because Germans, say what you want about the Nazis, they kept great records and they needed to have laws and everybody had to understand what those laws mm-hmm. were. Why did they need birth and death certificates for pigs?
Well, because all of the pigs, all of the poultry even on the island belonged to them. And so they had to keep meticulous records to make sure that every pig born on the island of Guernsey made its proper way into the stomachs of German soldiers on the continent. And in order to do that, they had to keep, population records of the pigs, because God forbid that a pig should end up on the table of a Guernsey Islander and being consumed by a non-German person. And likewise, the chickens, the ducks, the cows, the sheep, every animal had its records, and they were scrupulous and fearsome about keeping those records. It took a lot of thinking to outwit the record keeping of the Germans.
So typically a pig would be born, and if it died young, then they would be able to hide another pig that was born somewhere by giving the second pig, the first pig's death certificate?
Well, no, you took the dead pig around to various farms. You'd have your pig, it died, and you'd call up the agricultural officer and say, oh my gosh, my pig died. The agricultural officer would come out and give you a death certificate for the pig, but there you were with a dead pig. So you'd take the dead pig over to your neighbor who had a live pig, and the neighbor would likewise call up the agricultural officer and say, I've got a dead pig. You'd get a second death certificate, but you'd have a live pig. So there you'd have one extra pig, two death certificates. You could kill that live pig and eat it yourself, which is in the book, the genesis of the Literary Society dinner.
Mm-hmm. This is the most bizarre form of guerrilla warfare I've ever heard of in my life.
Well, the Germans got around it eventually. They tattooed the pig, so you couldn't fool them anymore.
The mind reels. Okay. I've been dancing around this, but there are a lot of really important things that you talk about in the book. It's very funny. I left all the way through the book, but there's also horror stories in this book and I won't go into them because each is its own little story. But Elizabeth McKenna specifically has a story that's very difficult. And I don't know how much of this you want me to give away.
I mean, I don't want you to give away what happens to her ultimately, because her story is complicated. She is the hero of the book, and she is the missing center of the book. She's the one character who never appears in the book. But they all talk about her all the time.
Yeah. Can we talk about Christian Hellmann?
Yes.
Why don't you tell us about Christian?
Well, Christian Hellmann was a German doctor who came to the island of Guernsey to take care of the troops on the island. He had been wounded on the Eastern Front and was therefore sent to the fairly cushy post on Guernsey. And while he was there, he falls in love with Elizabeth McKenna and she with him, and they have a child together. But the child is one that he does not live to see because he's transported back to the continent and dies in a shipwreck. On his way back to the continent. So he never sees his child. And I think that the point is that, of course, there were real, true human relationships between the islanders and the occupying Germans. I don't think you can live in the same small island with people for 5 years and not find, who's the true human and who's the real villain in that group. That's just the world of a small town. So, I mean, I think for the most part, from the research I've done, the German government was, the people who ran the place were real, stinkers, and yes, they were hated.
They were Nazis.
They were Nazis. But their people on the ground were just people on the ground suffering and working and trying to do their jobs and wishing they were at home and ultimately starving right alongside the islanders, which creates a human bond.
Everything that I've ever known in literature and movies and popular culture has been that the collaborator is scorned to the point of ostracism and even murder. Women who sleep with the occupying German troops are especially ill-treated. Mm-hmm. And this is not true of Elizabeth.
It's not true of Elizabeth. And I don't think it was true to that extreme on the island. There was an enormous increase in single mothers during and after the occupation, and they were obviously the children of German soldiers. But those girls, you know, they may have been scorned a little. They were called jerry bags. There were some mean names. Yeah, there were some mean names thrown, but nobody got murdered. Nobody got their head shaved. None of that, none of the stuff that occurred in France happened on the island.
There's a romance in here, too. Well, there's more than one. But the one I'm going to talk about, of course, is Juliet Ashton. So she is a young woman. She's, what, 32, 33?
32 and 33.
Yes. And she has never found a proper beau, although she's being pursued by, heaven help us, a crude, boorish, extremely rich American.
With beautiful teeth.
With beautiful teeth, as opposed to people in England who don't necessarily have beautiful teeth. Mark Reynolds is a jerk. Mm-hmm. But he's a powerful, rich jerk, mm-hmm. and after a while, he just begins to make Juliet's life miserable.
Right. He sees no reason in the world why she doesn't want to marry him, and if it's perfectly reasonable to him, it must be objectively reasonable, and he doesn't understand why she says no to him.
It would be a good business decision.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. There's no reason why she shouldn't marry him.
On the other hand, there's a man named Dawsey Adams running around the island. He's the Adelaide Addison call him the pig farmer?
Yes, that pig farmer.
Yes. We'll talk about her if we get a chance also. And Juliet, who just falls in love with everybody on the island except Adelaide, begins to find things going on with Dawsey that she would never have suspected.
I think that it's his love for Charles Lamb, which is what brought them together in the first place. He wrote her the very first letter from the island asking her to tell him more about Charles Lamb, whether Lamb had written more essays he could read. And right there from the very beginning, you know that Dawsey is a poet at heart because he loves Charles Lamb so much. And Juliet, you know, who also loves Charles Lamb, finds him a kindred spirit, although there's, you know, many obstacles in the way. The course of true love never did run smooth and all that. But you know, anybody who loves Charles Lamb has to be a hero.
And, okay.
Yeah.
And the thing that, if you read any Charles Lamb in an American school, there was a dissertation upon roast pig.
Yes, on a roast pig dinner. It's just wonderful.
It's a wonderful thing, yeah. How roast pig was invented. I'm not going to go into it here, but you really should read it. Charles Lamb, also known as Elia, E-L-I-A.
Yes.
If you do crossword puzzles, you know that. I know what I wanted to ask you. I ran across a term in your book that I had never run across before, and that was a Pictish ambush. Now, I know that the Picts their preferred method of warfare was to fight from ambush, but I couldn't relate it to the incident that you had in the book, which was something to do with a cellar door or something like that.
Well, she was playing with her godson. Juliet is playing with her godson, and so they were hiding behind the cellar door. It was one of those cellar doors that opens up out of the ground, and so they ambushed his mother, her friend, who was, I don't know, perhaps hanging up the laundry is how I had always envisioned it. And so they charged up the stairs and ambushed her. I don't think she ended up with an axe in her back, like a real Pictish
like
ambush.
Real Pictish. Nor did they paint themselves blue.
Right, and waggle their parts at her.
Kit. Kit is the daughter of Elizabeth McKenna and Christian Helmon. She is being nurtured by the entire, practically the entire island, but certainly the Potato Peel Society.
That's right.
Yeah. Different people get to have her in their home, and she is growing up a marvelous child, imaginative, precocious, and an inventor of a game I'd never heard of before, which is Dead Bride.
Well, actually, if you want the true truth, I personally am the inventor of Dead Bride. And when I first read the manuscript and I saw that Marianne had taken my very own game and put it in the book, I was so honored. I couldn't believe it. But yeah, my sister and I started the whole thing. We didn't have a laundry hamper. Kit plays it with a laundry hamper. We played it with blocks, but it's exactly the same game.
Tell us about Dead Bride.
Well, Dead Bride, you dress up in your curtains. If you're the bride, you get dressed up in your mother's old curtains, and you're preparing for the wedding. The groom has gone off to do whatever it is the grooms do, and then the bride is suddenly stricken and falls down and stuffs herself, in Kit's version, in the laundry hamper and dies. And then the groom comes back from wherever he's been and begins to wail and scream, "Where is my bride? Oh, dear, the bride is dead. The bride is dead." And then the bride leaps out of the laundry hamper and says, "No, no, no, I'm alive again." And then they kiss and then they get married. In my version, the bride sometimes didn't revive but stayed dead. And then the groom wailed and beat himself around the head and rent his garments. But either way, satisfying. Highly satisfying game. I highly recommend it.
Did you scare the adults that lived with you? I was just curious.
My mother said she thought it was so funny, but she also figured that we were scarred for life and that she had done some terrible thing to us as children that we would play this game.
It's an imagination, you know?
It's a great game.
Imagination is a two-edged sword, or some other cliche that means that. When all is said and done at the end of this book, things are wrapped up fairly nicely. It has a happy ending, or several happy endings, actually. And the one person who I really wanted to see get a final comeuppance really didn't, and that was Adelaide Addison, a scold, a gossip. And I was wondering, Addison, there used to be an Addison in English history who had a paper called The Tatler. Mm-hmm. Is that why you named
it? It shouldn't be, because we love Addison. You know, he was one of the people who had the Izzy Bickerstaff pseudonym. Joseph Addison was one of...
It all just wraps up.
Yeah, no, Addison. So we do love Joseph Addison, and I didn't mean to saddle him with Adelaide. I think it was just sort of the euphony of Adelaide Addison. Mm-hmm.
The only thing euphonious about her.
Yes, exactly. And she does get her comeuppance because she's utterly powerless, which is what infuriates her. She has not been able to ruin all of their lives, which is been her goal throughout, and so she's thwarted and mean and crabby, and everybody hates her. So,
yeah, this is also we have maybe a minute left, but this is a novel in a form which you used to see quite frequently in the 19th century, especially, and which has fallen to disuse: the epistolary novel, novel told in letters, and the letters that she writes to Juliet Ashton about the terrible goings on and the horrible Elizabeth Kent are really pretty funny.
Yeah, She's a shrew, but she writes a good letter, you got to admit.
Was it Marianne's idea to write the letter in an epistolary form, or write the novel in epistolary form?
Yes, it was. I asked her about it, and she said that she thought it would be easier for some. That's why she made the choice, which I think is very, very funny. But I think she did a brilliant thing, because all of the problems of the epistolary novel go away when you have 25 different correspondents. The problems with the form in the past have been you have two correspondents and they're both writing 40-page letters every night, which just, you know, staggers belief. You can't do that anymore. But with 25 different correspondents, you get all the exposition and none of the tiresomeness. So I think it's a brilliant choice. I love writing in this form.
You know, it's nice to keep up with email, but sitting down and writing a handwritten letter really is it's a thing from another time by now.
Yeah, but we could all do it.
We could all do it if we wanted to. It's been nice talking with you. I've been speaking with Annie Barrows, the co-author with Marianne Schaefer of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society, published by Dial. And we never got around to the potato peel pie, but people just have to buy the book.
You'll have to buy it. It's right in there.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.